and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
I feel like language is what completes a culture, and it's what completes like a people, because we look to the language for our histories, for where we are, where we come from, and all of our stories, all of our spiritual beliefs, those are all present within the language. And the more we speak it, the more we get that power, and it'll turn around and empower our people.
Bonjour, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem.
And I'm your other host, Cole Primo. Miigwech for joining us today. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show, right? At its core, a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week, we have captivating conversations with great guests from all different sorts of backgrounds. We're talking musicians, teachers, community leaders, doctors. They have a wondrous mixture of passions, and we talk to them about their gifts and how they shared them with the community and finding a purpose in our lives and amplifying Native voices. That's the goal. Leah, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's been a slightly stressful period of my life because we are in the process of purchasing a home. So, wow.
Yes, I'm knocking on wood.
Yeah, it's not official yet, but it's right in the home stretch here. So
the home.
I was gonna ask you, Leah, if you had any tips or anything for new homeowners.
Save your money.
That's what we've been doing, you know,
not
to get to this
house,
process.
But for your utilities, water heater, I don't know, anything, boiler. What else do we have? We have our septic system. You wouldn't.
Yeah.
Water softener. You name it. Have an emergency fund for those things, because you never know when it turns cold and your heat doesn't work. You're going to want to be able to be prepared and pay people.
When you moved into your houses, did that happen during the winter? Like, this is going to happen?
No. Heck no. It was like summer, just boiling hot outside, no problem. So
yeah.
What really was the difficulty was painting when it was warm outside.
Oh yeah, I can't wait to, you know, because we're going to be definitely painting a bunch, and thankfully it'll be through the winter and I won't sweat as much. I'll still sweat plenty, but that's definitely a priority of ours. But thank you. Yes, I was very curious. I know there's so much that goes into it. Watching all the YouTube videos, you know, so. Mm-hmm. But back to the show. Can't wait to speak with our guest today, Eileen Bass. Eileen is Hunk Papa Lakota, Muscogee Creek, and a citizen of the Sac and Fox Nation of Oklahoma. Eileen is currently an undergraduate student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, who is passionate about Indigenous narratives, language revitalization, tribal histories, supporting Native youth, and more. In the summer of 2023, she was also accepted into the Minnesota Historical Society's Native American Undergraduate Museum Fellowship Program. So I can't wait to hear about that and much more. And here she is. She just joined us.
Thank you, Cole, Leah, for inviting me. And Hamitakiyapi, Eileen Amakiyapiye. Awashichiria Alina Makiapie, Malakota, Oyate Mitawakin, Mopapa Lakota, Ga Muscogee Creek, Ga Sac and Fox Nation of Oklahoma, Uwichakiapi, Sakega Beshteke, Edamawapi Ish, Sac and Fox Nation, Edamawapi. So just to kind of break that down, again, I said hello, my relatives. My English name is Eileen, but I'm Akpapa Lakota, I'm Muscogee Creek, and I'm Sac and Fox Nation. I'm also Sac and Fox Nation of Oklahoma, but I'm enrolled as Sac and Fox. So just to kind of be like transparent about the intertribal relationship that I have with like kind of everybody. So I live in Minnesota, I live in Minneapolis, and I'm attending the U of M, studying anthropology and English with a minor in creative writing. And I'm also studying Dakota language. And it's become really important to me over the past I'd say like year and a half. So I'm very happy to be involved with those kinds of projects and then, you know, see where that takes me.
All right.
Great. We like to, you know, tag that question by just asking how you're doing and how's the family doing?
I'm doing pretty good, pretty well, aside from having like a little bit of a sinus infection, but it's the end of the semester. I think that most students would say that they're pretty busy at this time. I certainly agree. But if you keep working hard, then you'll reap the fruits of that labor. So I'm just trying to keep my head on straight. And I think, yeah, my family's okay too. How are you guys?
Yeah, no, good. Good, good, good. Thank you. Is there anything that's at the top of your mind, either you're spending a lot of time thinking about or that you're kind of geeking out about today?
Actually, that's a very good question. I feel like with the various organizations that I work with, there's definitely something about retaining Dakota presence here in Minneapolis. And even though I'm like technically not enrolled, you know, I've had great grandparents who were enrolled as like Sisseton, you know, maybe close to 100 years ago. But actually, I can think of a few schools around here who don't really incorporate Dakota language into the curriculums because it's like a budget issue. They'd have to ask for like funding or grant funding. I'm just thinking about like the fact that a lot of activism isn't really based around like this being like Dakota homelands. And it's like a historical thing to kind of think about. Actually, last night I went through a meeting for Palestine with the Red Nation. And that was like such a, I was so mind blown, but Nick Estes did a really good job just explaining that this is like Minnesota Makoche. And like if people relate land back with the fact that we're in Dakota homelands and Dakota were technically exiled, we should focus on like, you know, retaining the cultural continuity of the people who are here originally and support that in our school system. So, and that applies to the U of M too, where I attend school. So that's actually kind of part of like my, part of why I do language as well.
Great. You mentioned that in the last year and a half, your passion for like Dakota language began. Could you talk about, you know, how that process began? What sparked that passion?
So I think about 5 years ago, actually, this is whenever the Minneapolis American Indian Center was still having in-person classes. And I was told that they had like conversational Dakota classes in their basement. And this was like on Tuesdays and Thursdays during the evening. So I knew that I couldn't attend the U of M that semester. So I just decided to take advantage of like the free classes. And I got along well with the teacher at the time, but then I had to stop going because I had to go to school the next semester. And I was really busy. And so I think at the time, I knew that Dakota language is important to me because it's a dialect of Lakota language. And ideally, I'd be learning the dialect of like the Standing Rock community, which is in South Dakota and North Dakota. So that's pretty far away. And it would have been convenient for me to just start taking Dakota. But like, I feel like a lot of, whether you're Lakota or Dakota, you feel drawn to just, you know, the Dakota language programs here, because it is accessible, and especially if it's virtual, you kind of just get to know more of the community. So I came back like maybe in 2021 to Minneapolis. And then in 2022, later that spring, I started taking Dakota classes virtually again through the MAIC. And then I ended up becoming friends with the teacher who was, you know, taking care of that. And then I ended up working at the Dakota Yapi Wahohpi, which is the Dakota Language Nest on the U of M campus. And that was suggested to me through my teacher at the time, Shoshoka Dutta, who was teaching level one Dakota. So it's like, I was technically like, I'd say I've been consistently learning for a year and a half, but my journey started like before then, just like whatever piqued my interest was like started before then. So I've been kind of learning on and off, but I wouldn't say I'm an advanced speaker at all. I'm definitely like more intermediate. That's my comfort level.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're speaking with Eileen Bass, who is Hunkpapa Lakota, Muscogee Creek, and a citizen of the Second Fox Nation of Oklahoma. Eileen is currently an undergraduate student at the University of Minnesota who is interested in Indigenous narratives, language revitalization, tribal histories, supporting Native youth, and more. Do you have feelings that go along with learning the language? Anything that pops up, like empowerment, or I know sometimes for me with Ojibwe Mo'in, I feel a little vulnerable or lost sometimes. But yeah, any feelings that pop up for you?
Yeah, and I can definitely relate with how you're feeling, because since I'm also Sac and Fox, my dad's family, his paternal family, spoke two dialects of like Sac language, which is Bakyatiwayan in Sac, and then Meskwaki, which is, I believe it's Meskwak Atowayan. I started taking Meskwaki language classes, which is another dialect, again, of that language, just because it was like accessible. But that's the thing, there's like an ease when it comes to learning the language, because you are supported by like teachers and other students maybe at your level. They may not completely be comfortable or confident with it yet, but my grandfather actually helped start the Sac revitalization, like a Sac language program, in the 90s. And so he recorded his voice with like two other people who were also first speakers, and they created an app maybe 10 years ago, and they've updated the app since then, but the Sac language program is still going, and they have like a lot of resources for people who are members of the Sac and Fox Nation of Oklahoma. And so because he was like in his 70s at the time, I'm like in my late 20s, and this is someone who was like a first speaker, and he decided to do this in the 1990s, around the time that I was born. I feel like, you know, my path with language revitalization is really important to me. I feel like learning it here, because I'm in Minnesota, and it's like Dakota people are still here and they're still present, it's just like a way of like kind of honoring where I am and being very grateful for the people and the community that have been helpful with me, even if it doesn't have anything to do with language. So I feel like language is what completes a culture, and it's what completes like a people, because we look to the language for histories, for where we are, where we come from, and all of our stories, all of our spiritual beliefs, those are all present within the language. And the more we speak it, the more we give that power, and it'll turn around and empower our people. And, you know, it'll empower the next generation. So we keep that alive for them, and we keep it alive for our ancestors. So that's just how I feel about learning languages. I want to be like kind of a polyglot where I learn like Sac and Lakota at some point, but for now it's just like Meskwaki and Dakota.
That's great. Are you from Minnesota?
I'm actually from Illinois. So I'm from a very small town and very like in the middle of Illinois, Decatur, Illinois. But my mom's family has lived here since the 70s. So she's, you know, her family's all Akapapa Lakota, and they moved around, but they've been settled in like the kind of like the south side, I would say, you know, for a few decades at this point. So part of the reason why I moved here is also just to reconnect with them.
So you mentioned the Dakota Language Nest. I just want to hear a little bit more about that program. It seems pretty interesting.
Absolutely. We actually are in our second year. Last year was the pilot year, and we had only, I would say, like 5 children involved. And one of those families, or 2 of those families, were not Dakota. But this year we have had at least 11 kids enrolled, and it's kind of pending, but our cap is at 12. And at least, I would say, 8 of the 11 children are Dakota or Lakota. And so we've had like a first speaker for our lead teacher. We had an assistant teacher who was enrolled at Rosebud. And then there's me, there's another teacher who's Asante Dakota. She's from here, but it's like you always have to deal with the bands who are in diaspora. But then we have another assistant teacher who is Washichu. But pretty much Shoshoka Dutta just started this with the University of Minnesota Child Development Laboratory School. And this has been like a project that was in the works for like 5 or 6 years. And he was really inspired by the revitalization efforts in New Zealand and Hawaii to, you know, turn around and create this on the U of M campus. And it's incredible that, you know, we are able to even have this space for our Dakota or Lakota children, because I don't think that they're teaching in-person Dakota classes at the U of M anymore. And so the fact that we're still speaking Dakota like every day, at least every weekday, you know, on the U of M campus, or, you know, in proximity to it, is pretty you know, it's like something I go in there every day. I work there every morning, but you know, it's just important for me to like hear the slightest Dakota phrase, or when you see the children comprehend what you're saying to them in Dakota, it's like, it just means that it's working. And so we have to keep it going.
I mean, that's got to give you even more drive to do what you're doing, to see that in the children's faces. What's it like to see that in action?
I think that children are definitely easier to teach in that they just don't need words, or it's like hard for an older student, I would say. Like, we have like the 15-minute classes, which is every day, but that's only 15 minutes of someone's time that they're like kind of committed, they're writing things down, they're more focused. And in this environment, you can, like, they're able to hear the language at like, from the time that they get in to the classroom, which is around 8 o'clock in the morning, to whenever they leave, which is like closer to 4:30 in the evening. And so during that time, like, we're talking to them about food and the language, you know, they're able to comprehend, like, if we ask them if they're hungry, if we ask them what they did last night, we ask them if they slept well. Most of the time, like, it's just kind of depends how they're feeling, but it's like, you know, they either say, the boys say how, and then the girls would say han. But it's like, you just ask them questions, and the ones who are easily, I would say, like, the ones who are more talkative are probably going to be easier to teach. But it's also just a learning curve for children, because sometimes, as you know, the ones who are quiet, they just happen to be listening.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today we're speaking with Eileen Bass, who is Hunkpapa Lakota, Muskogee Creek, and a citizen of the Sac and Fox Nation of Oklahoma. Eileen is currently an undergraduate student at the University of Minnesota who is interested in Indigenous narratives, language revitalization, tribal histories, supporting Native youth, and more. So I saw this in The Circle, I believe, that you were named the Minnesota Historical Society's Undergraduate Museum Fellowship, or you became a part of that program. And part of that was digitizing tribal newspapers.
Yeah, so it was incredible to be part of the Native American Undergraduate Museum Fellowship with the History Center this past summer. I believe that they reached out to 6 different people, and they invited them as a part of like a fellowship. And then like it was like a hybrid with an internship. So the fellowship was really taking in seminars and learning about like more of museum practices, more of like, you know, history center practices, tribal museums, how to like learn from people who are a part of the different historic sites in Minnesota. We later visited those sites in person in August, but during the month of July, I would say our internships took up like, you know, most of that month, because we all had separate internships. So mine was for digitization of tribal newspapers. And I worked on We Speak of Ourselves, which was a newspaper from the late 70s and 80s. That's like, those are the issues that I worked on specifically. I physically scanned copies of the Lac des Flambeaux tribal newspapers, which were pretty like large to kind of handle. You had to run it through like a very wide scanner. But basically looking into those newspapers was finding out about tribal sovereignty and all of these like issues that are still very relevant today. But you're reading about like actors, Native musicians, Native activists from that time period, which I worked from like around 1990 to 1996, I believe. It's a pretty hasty process, but I really loved it, and I miss it. That kind of work and keeping the physical copies of something like that is, you know, it's important to digitize things for accessibility, but I hope someday that there is a space for those physical papers. That's just my personal opinion.
That was going to be my first question when I heard that you were digitizing tribal newspapers. Like, what was happening decades ago that stuck out to you?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Right. Actually, I found a couple of family members in there that, like, I had no idea that they were involved in some kind of activism at the time. My great-grandfather, Reginald Birdhorse, was at the time protesting the Minnesota River, the Minnesota River. And he did other activism work at the time, you know, protested the fact that they're mining the Black Hills for uranium. But I think that there was flooding because of a dam on the Minnesota River at the early 1990s. He was in the paper and as a representative of Standing Rock was talking about that. I saw another relative of mine who was an actor and he was passing through and was kind of seen in Chicago. He did some solidarity work for the American Indian Movement. And so just seeing like their name, I would take like a picture, you know, and send it to like my mom. And I guess it was in like the Lac-Des Flambeaux Tribal newspaper. Like, you know, this was in their reservations, like newspaper. And they just covered like so many people across the Native country. It was like a definite presence, whether they're mentioning like Russell Means and like why he did like the movie Pocahontas. But then they also would cover like very local things that were like, you know, about the community, just sending out like alerts for this program, or even like putting up Ojibwe language in the middle of the newspaper. Like they had Ojibwe language lessons in the middle of the papers. And so I was like, this is a really thorough paper, and it's covering like what's on the res and what's off the res. And I feel like that knowledge is just to be familiar with solidarity and like intertribal relationships, but also within your own tribe. I don't know. It's just like, I wish that that was something that was accessible to everybody.
Another thing I want to bring up is that you're a McNair scholar for 2023.
So the McNair program is, it comes from the TRIO program. It's a program at the U of M for, well, the McNair program firstly is for like first generation underrepresented students, like, and it's usually minority students, but also being able to offer the opportunity to pursue a research project for 10 weeks during the summertime with a mentor. And ideally they have a PhD, they also work at the University of Minnesota, but it's the opportunity to kind of explore your major and what you want to study in grad school, and just kind of get that experience of writing papers, of reading, of like, you know, looking at the research process and being able to have like a mentor kind of guide you. But also there's what McNair really helped with was being able to access like different graduate programs, being able to narrow down what you want, being able to understand how to apply for grad school, and understanding like the tuition and the costs and like why you would want to move to, what are the benefits and what are the like the expenses of really applying to grad school, but making sure that you're prepared. I think preparation was like the key thing with McNair. It helps in the graduate applications, because if an admissions committee is looking at your paper, they see that you did McNair, they're like, you know, oh, this person kind of understands what graduate school, that research process was like, or what it was like to complete a research paper in like a very short amount of time. So that was a really good experience. And I'm very grateful to McNair for letting me into that program.
And your research project was pretty fascinating, you know, Dakota activism.
I actually wanted to study urban relocation in Minneapolis, and I was inspired because of my father. He was part of the Indian Removal, like Urban Relocation Act, which was taking him from like his family from Tulsa to Los Angeles, California, which is where he was born. So that was in 1956. And I wanted to draw comparisons between like Los Angeles and Minneapolis. Once I got in touch with my mentor, he narrowed it down to me just talking about Minneapolis, but also about Dakota presence and like the American Indian Movement and what kind of factors played into the American Indian Movement as to where they are. I was mostly influenced by cultural anthropology, but my mentor was Nick Estes, and he was coming from like a historian's perspective. So we were able to come together on like ethnohistoric documentation about what the American Indian Movement was doing specifically in Minneapolis, what kind of survival schools were like helping retain cultural continuity, which, you know, would apply with the Dakota language classes that they would have offered for students. Did any kind of history inform the American Indian Movement? The fact that this is like Dakota people had to be removed from here, like the city of Minneapolis couldn't have been established as a settler colonial project without Dakota people being removed. And so I really had to go back into those treaties and explain the ongoing consequences of like the University of Minnesota. And then if you think about it, like even with Bedote and Fort Snelling or Bede Makaska and Lake Calhoun, you know, why were these places being renamed? And they weren't, like a lot of people fight still for things to have Dakota names on it, even though it's Minnesota Makoche. It's like Minnesota is where the land reflects the sky. And so that was the initial concept, you know, just kind of understanding that Dakota sovereignty and whether it had a relationship with the American Indian Movement. And the research kind of surprised me, but I'd say that there was solidarity with the American Indian Movement and the Dakota activism, but the Dakota activism is informed by something different. So like the American Indian Movement was informed by a lot of the policies at the time, which marginalized Native people in general. And AIM had to come up with the Indian Patrol. They had to come up with their own survival schools. They had to really combat a lot of the discrimination that was going on. But the Dakota activism is definitely informed by its like commitment to cultural integrity and its history, their history, you know, collectively in Minnesota.
Wonderful. So, Eileen, for other students or potential students who want to study language, do you have any recommendations on how to take action?
I would say that depending on like your circumstances, I know that it's not easily accessible for everybody to come to the University of Minnesota and take classes. That was like my situation 5 years ago. I still managed to come to the American Indian Center. And at that time, they didn't have virtual classes, so it was mainly in person. But I wanted to always come, first of all, kind of network and meet people, but speaking or learning the language and just kind of like breaking out of like any shyness when it comes to kind of meeting people. Like they kind of like the thing with learning language is that like you kind of have a script. And so you're kind of ease into saying things that you normally would feel like you wouldn't have to say if you're just meeting people like casually. So the language kind of helps break people out of their shells, I feel, and it does help create community. So attending, you know, language programs, if they're free, if they're virtual, accessible, that's all the better. But also practicing with people, that's another key point to doing these classes, is that you can always meet people and kind of find community. If you're a Native student and you want to attend like a book club, or you want to come to the American Indian Family Center, or just other like places where they're leading workshops on crafting, or that's going to help you network as well. And when it comes to learning the language, just be able to access like a dictionary, be able to access anything that you feel like is going to be useful, have a notebook.
Thank you so much. You know, clearly you got a lot of stuff going on. Do you have any future projects you're looking forward to?
Yeah, actually, I am a current interpretation assistant at the Wiseman Art Museum. And so one of our projects this coming spring is to create an interpretive land map guide instead of a museum guide, just so people are educated about the land that the Wiseman is on. And so creating materials in Dakota language, creating like an overview of the history, and even it could be in Dakota language as well. Probably going to learn about more stuff as time goes on, but it's just a good time to be here and learning the language.
Eileen, it's so fun.
I didn't have that much going on when I was in college, I tell you what. But it's great to see, you know, all the great work she's doing and, you know, digitizing tribal newspapers. Like, this is important stuff.
So, oh, yeah.
Miigwech to Eileen Bass. Eileen is Hunkpapa Lakota, Muscogee Creek, and a citizen of the Sac and Fox Nation of Oklahoma. Eileen is currently an undergraduate student at the University of Minnesota doing amazing work, and the future looks bright in Native country. Absolutely. Indeed. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening. Gigawabamin.
Gigawabamin.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Programming is supported by Bremer Bank, with bankers who know that in business, relationships matter more than ever, and understanding is everything. More at Bremer.com.
KFAI is proud to present Gothis New Year's Eve Leather and Velvet Ball at the Fine Line on Sunday, December 31st. Minneapolis Dark Wave Dance Night Gothis presents a New Year's Eve Leather and Velvet Ball at the Fine Line for all the goths, gays, and theys, featuring DJ Q, DJ Diaspora, a leather and velvet runway show, and more. Tickets for Gothis New Year's Eve Leather and Velvet Ball can be found at the First Avenue website. Visit first-avenue.com for more details.
This is Counter Stories, a podcast by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Anthony Galloway, partner at the Dendros Group and pastor of St. Mark AME Church in Duluth, Minnesota.
I'm Luz Maria Frias. I am happily enjoying life to its fullest.
I'm Halili, owner of The Other Media Group.
producer of Counter Stories and VP of Programming at Ampers.